Hi, this is Sarah O'Kelly with Skipper's Review, and I'm here today talking to Stephanie Palmer for Boat Radio. Now, Stephanie is the battalion chief. Fill me in on your title, because you just told me, and I can't.
No problem. It seems like a lot of battalion chief of the training division for the Coral Springs Parkland Fire Department, and I'm our dive team commander.
Okay, all right. So, now obviously with Boat Radio, what I'm interested in here, well, I want to hear all about everything, but let's start with the dive commander. So how did you end up in that? Well, how did you get interested in diving to begin with?
I was born and raised in Indiana, so I didn't grow up diving. I moved here in 97 from Indianapolis and got hired with the fire department in 2000. And there was an opening in 2001 with the dive team. It was pretty new. Our dive team's been around a while, but we transitioned from a volunteer fire department to a paid department in 2000. So about a year on, I decided I don't ever like to be in the position where if the opportunity is there to learn something new and to be effective in a rescue, I'm usually the one, and most of us, that sign up for things like that. So that's how I ended up getting a dive. I went on a couple dive calls, and I wasn't certified, and it really bothered me that I wasn't able to help more with that. So I went to the class. We did a public safety diver class and a dive rescue one class, which is out of an international organization that came down to train all of us, and I've been on it ever since.
So your dives, we were talking earlier today, your dives are mainly like canals and that kind of thing, or do you do some ocean diving as well for rescues? Do you go with the lifeguards?
No, typically for this city, we're surrounded by a lot of waterways, yeah. A lot of canals. We have the Everglades, we have the sawgrass that runs through our city as well. So most of ours are in lakes and canals, and sometimes out in the Everglades when we have to rescue airboat personnel or people on the airboats that have flipped over, things like that. That happens actually quite a bit. It's typically in the Parkland area.
With visibility in the lakes and canals, is that tough with visibility? Because I'm sure it's nothing compared to when you go into the ocean.
Absolutely not. It's completely different than an ocean dive.
Do you do ocean diving as well, personally?
Very little. Actually, very little recreational diving. We try to go out once a year for a fellowship dive with our dive team, just to basically refresh our skills in clear water. We do a lot of pool dives, a lot of training in the pool as well, so we can see what we're doing, and then we practice a lot in the lakes and the canals. So my experience really hasn't been with the recreational part. I have well over 250, probably closer to 300 dives over my 15 years of doing this, and every one of them has been in dark, black, nasty water.
Back to visibility. Yeah, so how do you do with that?
Well, I close my eyes. I've trained myself to close my eyes and listen and feel for what I'm trying to accomplish or find, and then if I get close enough to it, I kind of quickly open my eyes, and then just go from there. But you know, I've just trained myself to do that because there's so many weird and creepy things that you don't want that to stick in your mind like you would if you're on a reef and you see something beautiful. You want to remember those images. The images typically in a dive rescue with public safety, nobody really wants to remember that stuff. So that's how I deal with it. And it is very different from, like I said, recreational, because you cannot see. Even in the daylight, when it's 12 o'clock noon, we dive at noon, and anything over probably 8 to 10 feet, you can't see the hand in front of you. And with the silt and the things in the bottom of where we're going, it oftentimes distracts you and disorients you worse when you do have your eyes open.
Because you'll see light and it's not coming from where you think it's coming from. Why would it disorientate you more if your eyes are open?
If you don't have your bearings and you're not completely on the bottom of the surface, and you're swimming and the silt sometimes makes you feel like you're going up when you're actually going down, almost like a pilot in a whiteout, is what I tell my divers. Listen, you you have to be aware of all your gauges, all, everything that's going on around you. Watch your bubbles if you can in front of your face that are close. Just some of the things that are typical with recreational diving.
Yeah, if you were going like hundreds of feet, this is what you would have to deal with.
Absolutely. And anytime you get around the bottom of this stuff, you know, we've often had silt and muck that is probably well over 3 feet deep at some point. So we're very careful not to disturb the bottom too much because we have to do sweep patterns, so we have to go back over that same area. It's just a gentle balance between being very aggressive and trying to rescue someone and not completely disturbing the environment you're in.
So it's a very delicate situation. Mm-hmm. So did you come across gators?
Oh, yeah. They're okay when you see...
Do they run or do they come? Are they okay? Do they leave you alone?
Well, my biggest fear is the ones I don't see. It's typically what I tell people when I'm getting ready to dive on a mission or a rescue. Don't tell me where they are. I don't want to know where they are. I'm just here to rescue that person, get in there, and get out of there. But I have been on several training missions where we have seen alligators sitting probably within 5-10 feet of us when we're doing our patterns. And we notify, we have a communication system that's hardwired to our line tender. We have a line tender on the shore. And we tell them, you know, this is what I have. He's on my right or he's on my left.
Do you think maybe they've got a bad rap? They're not as...
I don't know a lot
crazy
about them.
As you, yeah.
I'd hate to comment on that because...
You don't want
to
even know anything about them.
No, but as long as I can see them and they're not bothering me, I won't bother them.
Right.
You know, my fear is always, and I think all of our fear is the snakes.
Okay.
You know, the water moccasins and down here can be pretty aggressive, so...
Does your dive gear protect you to a certain extent? Wetsuits and no.
We have dry suits now, which we merged over that a couple of years ago, just because of the contaminants that are in these waterways.
The pesticides and everything.
Absolutely. Full face mask, dry suits. It took us a very long time to get used to them and to kind of reacclimate ourselves with diving, because it doesn't change a whole lot with your buoyancy, but it does change a lot with your comfort level. And so it took us a long time to kind of get comfortable in that suit. And that's helped a lot, I think.
The full face dive masks, as opposed to having a regulator and just a eye mask.
It's excellent.
You like the full
we
face.
We love it because
okay. You can
the visibility
right?
is good, the communications are much better on our hardwire lines.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to worry about those contaminants in my face or my mouth. Like we dove years ago with just regular regulators.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started doing studies on the waterways and... You know, if your grass looks really green, it's
guess
probably
why.
Because there's something on it.
Yeah.
And the runoff from that goes right where we're diving, typically.
My daughter did a project for school just on that very topic, and it was scary, the amount of stuff that's going in there.
Absolutely. We're very fortunate. Our administration, actually my fire chief, our deputy chief, and then two other assistant chiefs are divers on our team. As well. So they understand what we need to get our job done efficiently and safely. And so that helps a lot with the team.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I have to ask, you are a woman in a very high position here with authority over, I would say, probably mostly men. Am I right in saying that?
Sure.
And how does it, do you get the respect that you feel that you would get as a man or as a woman? Does it make any difference? Are they... Once they talk to you and get to know you and see you know what you're doing, do you get what you feel is the full respect?
I think any time, it doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. In the fire service, it's an earned respect. And I wouldn't be where I am without their support and their respect for me. I owe a lot of where I am right now because of those people I've worked with. All the guys and all the girls I work with have really always had my back. And when I took over the dive team about 2 years ago, I've been in this position. It was a big transition for us because there wasn't a lot of consistency. It was a good program, but we've had people from different departments helping us kind of organize our training and our development. And my mission taking it over, and there wasn't a big line for this, trust me. There wasn't, because it's...
Why?
It's a thankless job. It's a necessary evil that needs to be done, and it affects our entire department when there's a dive call. And not everybody is a diver on this department. There's 28 current divers for our department. We have an average of 6 to 7 people per shift. But when a dive incident happens, we all go. And if it's June, July, and we're training, they're out there training. So you have to find that balance between making it interesting and relevant to those that are not divers and helping them understand what we're going through when we're underneath the water. I tell people all the time, the fire service is very dangerous and we have a lot of different specialty teams, but the dive team is the only one that one breath will kill you. But any diving operations, even if you're doing recreational, that's the only thing you'll ever do that one breath will kill you or can kill you. And we rely so heavily on our shore-based support and who's on the top of the shore guiding us. And so it's trying to find that balance and earning their respect in that way. So when I do training missions and we do training evolutions, I'm not wasting their time. I don't like to have my time wasted, and I know they don't, especially when it's 98, 100 degrees outside. So we try to keep it just small and relevant. As far as being a woman in this position, it's just a matter of earning your respect throughout the years. I've been here over 16 years, and I've worked my way through the ranks, and I really do contribute to the people that I've worked around because they've taught me some hard lessons, and they've, you know, taught me good and taught me bad. So
it's irrelevant. So in your particular position, there's no way you could get to the level that you're at unless you have already worked up to the spot that you are, and so that's... there's nothing that can be said about that.
Right. And I respect them. I respect our teammates. I respect our crews. You know, I took over the training position actually in January of this year. I was a captain on an engine for, well, about 10 years. I was a driver engineer before that. And the training aspect, whether it be our in-service training, doing fire training or medical training, or specialized with the dive team, it really, my motivation and my mission is to just make sure everybody goes home safe. Whatever tool they need, whatever training they need, that is my mission. And I feel such a overwhelming responsibility, not only to them, but to their families that I've met.
When you think about it, when you say it like that, it's a very nurturing position. So actually, to have a woman in this particular position seems even more of a natural thing, you know, because your whole role is to keep people safe and to make sure that they're okay and to nurture them. So in a sense, I mean, I know not baby them, but in a sense, take care of.
Well, there's a lot of tough love around here.
Mm-hmm.
And then every once in a while I do get the, okay, mom, you know, from the guys. So I get it. And I tell them, listen, I'm just looking out for you. That's all. I just have a responsibility to look out for you and we're good.
So speaking of mom, you said you have a couple of kids.
Yes, I have.
So tell me about them.
I have a daughter that's 8. And a son that's 11. They're soon to be 9 and 12. They're fantastic. They're awesome. I mean, they're just my little adventurers. They'll go do whatever, and it's great. They're awesome kids. They love lacrosse. They like to snorkel. I told them they're not ready to dive yet, so we'll kind of bridge into that as we go. But fortunately, they were born and raised down here, so we've had the opportunity to be around a water and do a lot of water activities, whereas where I grew up, it was on the Ohio River, and the visibility wasn't that great. You were great at skiing, but you didn't want to go under the water.
And you met your husband. You started telling me before, and I said, wait, hold on to that one, because I want to hear that story. You met him at a gas station.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Tell me about him.
When I first started the fire service, I said, I'm not going to never, ever go out with a police officer, never, ever go out with a fireman. Stay out of this business. Well, I met my husband at a gas station, and he is a sheriff, and so he comes to me at the gas station one day, and I was coming into work, and he was leaving, and he says, can you help me? And he says, you work for the fire department, right? And I said, yeah, I'm getting ready to go to work, and he said, I locked my keys in my car, and I thought,
you locked
in
the
really?
Keys in the car trick.
You know? Yeah, exactly. So I thought, that's such baloney. So I checked and he did. So I said, no problem. I'll be right back. I'm going to go to the fire station. I'm going to get a tool. And he says, well, what are you going to get? Don't you have one of those Slim Jim things to pop the door open? I said, no, I have an axe. I'm going to break the window. And he goes, you can't break my window. And I said, well, then you shouldn't have locked your keys in your car. So that, and then so we started seeing each other ever so
total
often.
Total love after that.
It's crazy. He's like, you're still trying to break things all the time, you know? So that's how we met. And then we didn't see each other for quite a while, probably 6-7 months. And we were out one day and we kind of ran into each other. And he wasn't in uniform. I wasn't in uniform. And I, you know, good looking man. Mm-hmm. And that's how it all started.
Isn't that amazing that you ran into each other 6 months later? So you didn't exchange numbers or anything. You just happened to run into each other.
No, we just ran into each other and started talking. And we had, and neither one of us talked about work. And that was really a big thing for me because I didn't want to be around somebody that talked shop the whole time. And he just had more interest in life than just work. And he would always tell me, it's what I do. It's not who I am. And I've respected that because sometimes in this profession, you can really get overwhelmed with the job. And then some people become the job. And I wanted to have interest outside of work.
What interest did you end up finding outside of work?
Anything outdoors, I will do. I like to bike ride. I swim a lot. I run. I just like to be outdoors. I like to go camping. We're really active in the lacrosse community. Both my kids play, so we're really into that now. And we just, if there's idle time, there's something to do. Always with us. We very rarely stay idle in our family. So outdoor activities are fantastic.
So you started doing the diving because you felt like, okay, there's a gap here where maybe I could help somebody and I don't have the qualifications to do it, so I'm going to become a diver. But you stuck with it. What made you then make that the main part of your career, the focus of your career, let's say?
That's a tough question. I just never felt like I wanted to give up on this. I enjoyed doing it, oddly enough, even with your eyes closed in black water. You know, a lot of people, with us being a member, we have approximately 170 line personnel. There's only 28 divers. So if that tells you the percentage of what we currently have, not a lot of people want to do this. And I think you have to be off just a little bit with your thinking when you do something like this because there's such a huge risk and oftentimes very little benefit to it because of the downtime for people, how long it takes for people to call an incident in, you know, the drowning prevention. That's really one of my main focuses, why I stayed in it. Is because there's always a lesson learned with this, and I try not to, and not just me, we have a lot of people on our department that are on our team that are really big into drowning prevention. And, you know, I just thought it was an important thing to do, and it just never really bothered me that much to want to stop doing it. And then to take over the position, I wanted some consistency. I wanted to make sure what we were doing, and not just me, I wanted to make sure all of us had the best practices with what we were doing with our training and really training to things that were very relevant to what we were doing. And that really was my focus.
Would you ever consider switching over to Coast Guard rescue and doing that kind of diving, ocean rescues?
I would love to. If Coral Springs would deploy me to the ocean, I would go right now and jump either out of a helicopter or off a boat to do that. I have a lot of friends that work for the city of Miami. Fort Lauderdale are on the dive teams, and they tell me their stories. And
I gotta talk to
they've
them
got
next.
Great stories because they're on beautiful, clear water. You know, they can see what's going on around them, and then they ask me, and you know, of course, they look at me differently and say, wow, that's tough what you're doing. And I said, well, jumping out of a helicopter off a boat is too, you know.
Everything's relevant.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And especially after doing it in such dark, difficult waters, I would think if you switch to the ocean, it would be, you'd use a lot of your skills in that area because they don't have those skills. I mean, maybe they should do that. Maybe the ocean guys should switch to the canal guys and the canal guys should switch to the...
Tell you that when we have done our ocean dive for our fellowship dive for our team and to really hone our skills where we can see,
mm-hmm.
You're a lot more comfortable in your suit and your skin when you're doing your skills assessment than when you're out here and you can't see what you're doing. It's a completely different ball game. And I have had people on my team that are excellent ocean rescue divers. They have hundreds of hours logged.
Let's get these guys to stop. So we were just quieting down the rowdy firemen. Let me show you this. This is her office. It's piles of...
It's less than organized right now. I'm actually waiting on we just ordered an 18-foot trailer for our training evolutions. So we're going to keep all of our gear centralized
nice.
In one trailer.
So
it's air-conditioned. We have a decon station. It's fantastic. So
mm-hmm.
we've waited a long time to get something like this. We currently have dive gear on every one of our apparatus. So we have a set on our engine and our rescues. And our divers are spread out throughout the city. So when a dive call comes in, they can respond from whatever station they're in right now, which helps. I would like to have it centralized, but I think it's important to kind of spread out the wealth and
mm-hmm.
because it gets the divers on scene faster in order to start initiating some of that pre-dive operations.
Are there any stories that you can tell me about one of your rescues that maybe people could find... either learn from or find interesting, and may not name any names or anything,
right.
but I know they're all probably difficult to talk about. What about a happy ending one? Oh no,
I'm trying to think. I'm like, a matter of fact, the one that comes to mind when you talk about happy ending one, years ago before the Sawgrass built the retainer walls or the sound barrier walls, there wasn't anything there. And we used to get a lot of dive calls off the Sawgrass.
Mm.
And one woman actually called it in and told us specifically where she was. I'm in the car. It's filling up with water. And she's telling us, this is what's happening. I accidentally, lost control, drove off. And when we pulled up, she successfully got herself out of her car. But it was in the middle of a really wide canal. And she was standing on top of the car waving at us. So I didn't think, but I just waved back, like, how you doing? That's great. Fantastic. You got out, So we actually deployed a really long ladder to her, and one of us shimmied down the ladder and said, this is what we're going to do. We've ended up putting a PFD or a flotation device on her and hooking her to a rope and said, you got to come with me. And she says, well, I'm really scared of ladders. And I thought, well, do you want to stay here or do you want to go on shore with us? She said, I think I'll be all right. So I thought that was pretty funny. But that was the first thing that came to her mind when she's in the middle of a canal.
The
and
ladder.
Her car sinking is that I don't really want to get on this ladder. And I thought, man, that would be my first choice. But there's been, on average, we average probably in this city, I would say... The last time I ran the numbers last year, we averaged 1 to 2 calls a month on an average on an actual incident. So, and it could be more this past year. I haven't ran the numbers yet because we started servicing Parkland a few years back. It's actually been a while now, probably 6-7 years now, if not a little bit longer. And they have all the Sawgrass out there and all the Everglades. Well, a lot of airboat accidents. Some of them are not fatal. Some of them are not... real bad. However, they still need to be rescued. And they're stuck out there. And if anybody knows the Everglades or Florida in the summertime, once the sun goes down, typically all the creatures come out. So we've been working closely with Broward County Sheriff's Office with their air rescue. We have drop bags now for people that are on airboats or any type of boats that get stuck out there. If they call in and say, I'm on a boat, I'm approximately in this direction, the beauty of smartphones, we can ask them the GPS coordinates, and we'll dispatch the air rescue out there. They'll put a drop bag. The drop bag has water, sunscreen, bug spray. It has a handheld radio in it, and it has blankets in it. So that's something that we kind of worked with them on developing some kind of system to help these people before we get there.
And typically it's like the engine breaks down or they tip over or...
It could be a multitude of things. And typically, like you said, either ran out of gas, the motor's not running, or airboats are very easy to flip over if they catch an edge, they call it. If they catch an edge, they flip over. And we've had a lot of incidents like that.
Mm.
That's been a little crazy because now you're contending with the predators and their habitat. and you're going where they are, and that gets a little hairy at times.
Especially if you have kids and everything else.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I think really the message I would add to that, and I wouldn't mind adding some of that story,
mm-hmm.
but the message I want people to understand is anytime you're in the water or your vehicle's gotten in the water, you cannot panic. You have to try your best to think about your ways to get out of it. When we talk about prevention and public education, when it comes to diving, there's so many incidents every year that vehicles go into the water. Florida is notorious for that. There's waterways everywhere.
They used to have like public, you know, things, but they had the wind down windows. So mm-hmm. what do you do now with the electric windows?
A lot of times I have actually been in the water diving on incidents where the lights are still on, the hazards are still going, all the electronics on the inside of the car are still on by the time we've gotten there. And our response time is typically 4 minutes or less. That's our goal. We are somewhere around 4 to 6 minutes.
Like Superman. How do you do that? 4 minutes. That's crazy.
It's a combination between when someone calls it in, when dispatch process the call, and then we get to the truck. And most of us are getting dressed in the bays and ready to go by the time we hit the seat. So when we get on those incidents, we're flying out of the truck, throwing our gear on our backs. We do a quick safety buddy check. We have our safety divers lined up and our 90% diver, which means he just has to be ready to go. Not everything completely on, but he's basically the third on deck. And it just happens. I mean, it happens so fast. And we had an incident years ago, and it was a tragic incident. It affected our community greatly because there were 4 children involved, and 3 of the 4 didn't make it. Their car had gone into a canal. And I think one of the most important things I tell people, and especially my family, you know, they think I'm Safety Sam. They're constantly like, oh, great, and something else to think about. You know, you see gloom and doom. No, I'm just trying to make you situationally aware of what's going on. And one of those things are, if your car goes into a canal, it is so important not to panic. And I think that's a learned skill sometimes by people. You have to practice this thing. But you also have to be aware of what's around you. And everybody gets in their car every day to drive. But how many people have a center punch or a seatbelt cutter in their car? And there's so many of them out there that are available. You stick it, you double side tape, whatever is easy, you stick it underneath your dash, under your steering wheel.
Why don't cars supply that when they're being manufactured?
I don't know. That's a good question. Maybe they assume nobody's ever going to go in that water, you know, when they,
yeah.
There's a lot of safety features that we could probably, as an organization and a fire department industry, recommend to manufacturers of vehicles.
And so what is it called again? A window what?
You want to look for, they have multi-purpose tools, and you want to look for a center punch, which will break
punch.
The glass. Will break the glass, not on the windshield, but it will break the glass on your driver's window, passenger windows, even the back window of the car. And a seatbelt cutter. And some of those things are like a combination tool. It looks like a little hammer. And super lightweight, plastic, doesn't take a whole lot.
Because if your click gets jammed and you can't get it out of the thing, never thought of that.
That's not what you're thinking of usually. No. It's like, hey, I have to take my seatbelt off. You're thinking of, I need to get out of here. So those are really important things that I tell people. You know, just put one in your car, but don't leave it in your glove box.
Mm-hmm.
Don't leave it somewhere where you're not used to having it and seeing it. Like, I have a tool on my keychain, my personal car, that's a Rescue Me. It's called a Rescue Me, and it's just a little bitty plastic center punch and a seatbelt cutter. Very inexpensive. You know, I give them out as Christmas gifts. Of course, my family thinks, you know, great. Now we're going to go into a canal. You know, 1 year I gave them extinguishers. I should probably work on my gift-giving skills, but, you know, whatever.
Oh,
but,
thank you when a
yes.
fire happens
yeah.
when the seatbelt needs to get cut.
Exactly. So those are things to think about. And the other thing that we experience a lot here, not so much with the diving end of it, but drownings. And we have so many drownings in the city a year from pools, lakes, canals, for unattended children. if somebody's not watching them or they just turn away for a second. I have two kids. It's almost happened to me twice with my own kids at my own house. I think I lost about 3 years off my life when that happened. You know, and I'm thinking, wow, I'm in this industry, and it just happened in front of me. But it happens so often around here.
What's the age bracket, like around between 2 and 6 or something?
I would say that's a fair number.
Mm. And they start walking and they have no sense.
And they just go in a second.
Yeah.
Or you're busy. We've often had them where they're at parties. There's a lot of people there. The kids are playing. Everyone's having a good time. They look over. They think the kid's playing in the pool. And they're actually not playing in the pool. And they're at the bottom. We've had several of those. That's just to make you aware, you know, of what your surroundings are. Even with the diving, you know, that's the same thing. I tell my divers, listen, it's the hardest thing you'll ever experience in your career is when you have to rescue a child in a car or a young adult. You know, those affect us worse than...
Stephanie Palmer of the Battalion Chief, Fire Rescue, and Dive Chief, right?
Dive Team Commander.
Dive Team Commander. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And your information and your stories.
Thank you very much. Okay.